Welcome to episode 11 of the Mitchell Institute Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and today's episode is going to focus on getting to know America's newest fighter, the F-35. And we're going to do it by talking to some of the Air Force fighter pilots who are currently flying the jet. If there's one thing you need to know about the F-35 is that it comes down to stealth and information dominance. Stealth makes it harder for an adversary to find, fix, track, and target the jet. And that kill chain involves multiple processes, and stealth makes each one harder to execute. So it's not that we're making the jets wholly invisible in a silver bullet fashion. It's that stealth degrades critical aspects of the kill chain process to a point that the adversary can't take a successful shot. Add that to speed and maneuverability, and a pilot's odds of survivability increase significantly. We've talked a lot about this technology's power during the Desert Storm episodes. It's more relevant than ever 30 years later, and the technology has come a long way from both a performance and maintainability perspective. Regarding information, the jet is equipped with a huge array of sensors and processing power that far outstrip what I had in the F-16. This allows the pilots to understand their battle space to maximize their advantages as they execute their missions while minimizing the points of vulnerability. Let's face it, success comes down to being at the right place, at the right time, and with the right tools. And the F-35 takes this to a new level. Add the powerful data links, which allow the jets to team seamlessly, and this really is a game-changing jet. And by teaming, I mean sharing information across a huge net in the region, or actually allowing geographically distributed jets to decide who is in the best position to execute an action. So one jet may be in a better spot to gather information, but another jet might actually be able to take a shot harnessing the shared data because it's in a better position. You add all of this together, and it is a huge deal. Think about it like going from a flip phone to a smartphone. Sure, either can make a call, but the smartphone's new approach to multi-role functionality and information accessibility has fundamentally changed how we live our lives. Stealth and information dominance are also changing how pilots fly and fight. Back in the day, we used to say speed is life, but today the mantra is evolving. It's all about understanding the battle space better than your opponent, and how to best position yourself to net your mission goals while avoiding points of danger thanks to stealth and situational awareness. And it's important to emphasize, in the modern era, stealth, information dominance, and advanced performance characteristics taken individually are no silver bullet. It takes a collaborative approach between these attributes. That's why the older version of a stealth aircraft like the F-117 are not really relevant today. They lack the sensors, processing capability, and connectivity to the broader net, and the situational awareness they needed to make smart decisions in a dynamic battle space. Pilots literally took off on a mission profile based on the information that could have been hours or days old. And once they crossed into harm's way, they literally pulled in their antennas and cut themselves off from the outside world and solely trusted in the stealth capability and the route that the mission planner thought was the best flight profile. The same point holds true for new build examples of non-stealth design aircraft like the F-15 or the F-16. They may have top-end information capabilities retrofitted, but without stealth, the enemy can see them plain as day, and it doesn't matter how good the internal guts are if you're shot down. So today's episode is all about collaborative capabilities, stealth, information dominance, and specialized mission characteristics. The idea for the F-35 originally came into the fold in the 1990s. The Air Force, the Navy, Marine Corps, and several allies knew that they were going to buy a lot of new jets when types like the F-16, F-18, the Harrier, Tornado, F-4, and a bunch of other types built decades ago were going to need to be replaced. The idea was that if the U.S. services recognized and enough allies could agree on a single type design, then they would enjoy production and sustainment efficiencies that could ultimately be translated back to more buying power for better quality jets. To put it in simple terms, it was all about securing operational realities, not extra overhead costs involved with building multiple fighter types. In historic terms, the F-35 is a young program. The services have just begun to acquire them in volume, and there are numerous tech upgrades planned for the jet. Folks who fly and sustain the airplane are still learning things to do. And this is normal. And the program isn't trouble-free. It's had its share of issues. However, that's pretty normal when you think about fielding a new fighter. Back when the F-16 first populated Air Force ramps, they had tremendous problems. In fact, there was a dark joke going around Hill Air Force Base that the easiest way to get an F-16 was to buy an acre off the end of the runway and wait. So the reality is that any new type needs to work through its teething problems, and it's important to keep the focus on the broader trends. And it's clear the F-35 is going to be a serious contender. So with that, I'd like to introduce two F-35 pilots, Major Justin Hazard Lee, a well-known F-16 and F-35 pilot, content creator and host of the Professionals Playbook podcast, and Captain Kristen Bayo-Wolf, the F-35 demo pilot who thousands of you will see this summer at air shows across America. Also, I'd like to welcome Stephanie Strickland. Steph is an Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist and aerospace influencer, connecting our Air Force to an international audience across numerous social media platforms in her work with the Experimental Aircraft Association. Steph will be hosting this episode with me, so Steph, let's kick it over to you.
Thank you, by the way, for making me a part of this great team. I'm excited to extend the conversation into new circles for what you're accomplishing here with the Aerospace Advantage. I'm thrilled to have the opportunity today to talk to someone who I have worked with a number of times, specifically as it pertains to her flying the F-35 demo, and that is Bayo. Hi, Bayo.
Hey, Steph, and thanks, guys, for having me on the podcast. Really appreciate it.
My first question is coming to you, Bayo. One of the ironies of the F-35 demo, as impressive and as loud and as awesome as it is it cannot, by nature of what you do, show off the aircraft's most important attributes when it comes to information dominance. How do you then steer the conversation when you have an opportunity out at an air show or in any number of the interactions you have with the community to talk about this? You take an F-16, you take an F-35 to the uninitiated, they both look like pointy nose jets, but the reality is there's very different things going on inside.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Even during the demo or even during a walk around, it's hard to tell people exactly what the F-35 does because there's nothing on the outside to really look at. All of that advanced technology is on the inside of all the surfaces of the jet. So that's already tough enough as it is. And then the demo is just, showing off the aerodynamic capability of the jet. So I just try to tell people that, our displays and the amount of essay that we get inside the cockpit is so advanced, being a fifth generation jet, that we can take young lieutenants just out of pilot training, put them in this airplane, and they're able to make decisions that people back in fourth gen and prior jets were just not able to make by themselves. And it just makes them so much more lethal than prior generation fighter pilots. So that's pretty cool to see with such young fighter pilots.
Hazard, this question is for you, and sticking in that same theme, with the capabilities of the F-35 that Bayo just explained, sensor fusion and things of that nature, can you talk us through how a strike package would be built going against, maybe a high threat target using a fourth generation like the F-16 that you flew compared to the F-35 that you now fly?
Well, Slick, thanks for having me on the podcast. Well, I can't talk to specifics of the strike package. I can say that it's fewer. It's a lot fewer in terms of the number of aircraft that we need. And remember, the aircraft that are going into a hostile country, it's just the tip of the iceberg. If you're trying to force project long distances, each aircraft that you can save makes a huge difference. And in terms of a near peer, highly contested environment, I would say that it's not even really possible to do with the fourth gen fighter. The ALR just won't be possible. So we have an acceptable level of risk. So that starts at low. That's what we've been doing in Iraq and Afghanistan. You have ALR medium, which is what Desert Storm was mostly fought at. You have ALR significant, that's like linebacker two. ALR high, that was a lot of the German bombing raids during World War II. And then ALR extreme, that's the Doolittle raid, where you're not expecting to come back. And so those fifth gen assets that are stealth, sensor fusion, great sensors, networking, that makes it a lot more survivable in a contested environment. And the enemy always has a vote, so they don't necessarily have to adhere to the game plan you think they will. So they might not fight like Desert Storm, where they're turning on their radars and allowing us to roll them back. They could, one of the things that I think of is the SAM operators during the Kosovo War. So like a Serbian colonel named Zoltan Dani, who he had seen during the 1982 Lebanon War, where Israel dominated the Syrian SAMs, taking out like 29 out of 30 in 2 hours. And so they practiced a lot of IMCON, limiting their rad times. He was in charge of an SA-3 battalion. It's typically a static site. They were able to move around. And in the 78-day war, we shot dozens of HARMs, didn't hit a thing. He was able to take out a F-117 and potentially took out an F-16 flown by Lieutenant Colonel David Goldfein, who went on to become the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. So a fifth-gen fighter brings you more options, with fewer aircraft, and it's more survivable during those, due to those attributes, which, you know, don't really get talked about a lot. Like, you know, losing a pilot, that's hard to quantify, but it's obviously a terrible thing in terms of what it looks like in the press, as well as, you know, us going into combat and potentially getting shot down.
Hazard, you'll hear us talk a little bit about a press, but in a different capacity. And I want to dig a little deeper into something you said, but I'm going to start off with Bayo in this case, especially Bayo, because you've flown both the F-22 and the F-35. Both of these platforms have been taken to war. So in your opinion, what are some of the biggest observations the fifth gen community is taking away from these experiences?
Yeah. What's cool about it is that you can expect to see probably like the Raptors and the Lightning and B-2s, you know, that first night of the war, like Hazard was talking about, just because we are survivable. And it's that stealth that gets us in on, you know, night one or night two, where all those other assets are not going to be survivable and can't go in as far as we can. So it's a huge jump in technology in both the Raptor and the Lightning that we're seeing in fifth gen. And that makes that, you know, cost per effect that we're talking about so valuable. When you can take, you know, like Hazard was talking about, just so much more fewer aircraft that are more survivable, and we can get in further to have those effects, either offensive or defensive, that we're looking for.
Bayo, that's a great answer. Hazard, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think we're just tweaking our operations. So any new fighter is going to have some bugs to work out. So it's the crawl, walk, run. So initially you fly these aircraft around the flagpole, find issues, and then fix those. Then you send them TDY, so red, like red flag at Nellis Air Force Base. You find more issues. Then you deploy them to a different continent in a peacetime environment. You find more issues. And then finally you deploy them into combat. And, you know, right now it's not highly contested, but we're still finding, you know, new issues to work out. For instance, on the F-35, there's a lot of civilians that are associated with deploying. And so we're trying to figure out, you know, what's the best way to do that. So there's not been, I think, a lot of chances to see, you know, how to change our tactics, but in terms of being able to just get it into the combat zone has been big. And then also, I think it's big from a marketing perspective. So you usually don't hear marketing and combat in the same sentence, but, you know, F-35, extremely expensive. People want to see it in combat, dropping bombs. They want to see the jet doing stuff. And so I think it's important to send it into combat and show what it can do.
Yeah, that's a great point, Hazard. I mean, Americans deserve to see the technology that they invest in being used in the way that it was purchased to do so. So, Bayo, one of the things that both of you had mentioned, I really want to dig into this a little bit deeper, and talking about, you know, teaming, how jets communicate and work collaboratively to execute a mission. Can you run us through, you know, maybe a little bit of, you know, I know from a Wavetop scenario of how we're seeing new concepts of operations unfold because you have better capabilities to communicate?
Yeah, I mean, both the Raptor and the F-35 are going to have that intra-flight data link where we're talking to each other and sharing a lot of data between the platforms. And a lot of that's happening in the background to where, you know, the pilot doesn't even have to command that. And it's just happening and making us, you know, that much more lethal as a 4-ship or even an 8-ship going out there together. And then obviously we still do standard Link 16 between both 5th-gen fighters and 4th-gen to the AWACS and such. So that stuff is still standard and, you know, what people are used to hearing about through 4th and 5th-gen. But that data passage, because both, you know, 5th-gen technology, a lot of it is about sensing what is out there. And when we can do that, and we can do that as a 4-ship, we can do that really wide in a tactical environment, you know, cover a large area of the airspace. It's very, very powerful for us to be able to gather that data, for the jet to be processing it without even the pilot doing that or having to, you know, really work that hard to get all that data that's just projected in front of them on the displays. It allows that pilot to be a lot more hands-off, the workload to be reduced, and for them to be making decisions, even like I said, as that lieutenant that's going out there fighting combat all the way up to the squadron commander, to be able to make the same sort of decisions with all that SA in front of them.
Hazard, we've definitely covered a lot of ground, but I want to talk a little bit about the driving need to extend into the fifth generation space. So you've got the F-22, you have the F-35, and now you have soon the B-21. A lot of times when I communicate in the aviation and air show space, I talk about building a football team as opposed to having one player that tries to do everything. Talk to me about what's driving this need for fifth generation aircraft.
Well, it has to do with survivability. So if you are going against a near peer adversary in a contested environment, fourth generation aircraft are just not going to survive. And one of the reasons is SAMs can iterate faster. So it takes on the order of 20 years, $50 to $100 billion in R&D to make a new fighter. And that has to do with the thing has to fly, first of all. It has to be safe because a pilot goes into it. SAM sites can be a lot more like science projects. And so it can iterate faster. They don't have to fly. And so you see, I mean, you're not talking about SA-2s, SA-6s anymore. These are really lethal SAM sites. And a fourth generation fighter is just not survivable. For instance, stealth, it's not something you can just sprinkle on a F-16. It has to be baked in. So like the F-35, if you look at it, doesn't have all the scoops and air vents that an F-16 has. You know, it has to have like an air conditioner to cool all that stuff. So you can't just strap that on to an F-16. And that's why I transitioned to the F-35. So I flew the F-16 for 6 years. And I was a Block 50 F-16 pilot, so doing the Wild Weasel mission. And we were going to some advanced exercises. And we couldn't go into the MEZ. So the F-6 or the F-22s, the F-35s, they were going in doing the mission while we were, you know, safely out of the MEZ. So that's why I transitioned. And, you know, FI is a big part. So these fourth-gen fighters, they're going to be with us till the late 2040s. So they're going to be with us for a long time. And so just like you talked to, this is not like a 1v1 cage match. It's a lot more like an NFL football team. And so we're the quarterback. We can raise everybody's game by flying with them.
And Hazard, you know, having been a Wild Weasel myself, you know, the first in, last out mentality means a lot different thing to you all in an F-35 compared to an F-16. And it really causes me to think about, obviously, we're specifically been talking about our United States Air Force. But as we know, if we're going to go into, you know, any of the ALRs beyond low that you had mentioned before, we're probably going to be talking about missile engagement zones along with allied partners and penetrating those as needed. So what does it mean for us to be able to partner with our allied folks, coalition folks out there flying the F-35? And how is it different compared to dissimilar aircraft? And, you know, obviously I want to hear from you, Hazard, and open that up to Bayo as well.
Yeah, so we're trying to build, you know, mission commanders, team leads here. And so you have to know, you know, your allied forces, the aircraft they fly and their capabilities, you know, similar to go back to the last example of being a quarterback, you have to know, you know, what every player on the team can do. And by them flying a similar aircraft, you know, their capabilities, there might be some tweaks here with their mentality or their tactics, but you're on the same sheet of paper. So it's a lot more seamless. It's a lot easier to communicate. And as you know, like if you go to Red Flag those first couple of days, it's a disaster in terms of just the small stuff, getting on the link, being able to communicate. So that's the really tough thing about going into combat. It's not this 1v1 thing. It's hundreds of aircraft going in against potentially hundreds of other aircraft. And they're not limited to the air. So you're fighting against SAMs on the ground, cyber space. So it's a complex problem, and having people on the same sheet makes it easier to communicate, which is one of the most important attributes to combat.
Just to pile on that, you talked about kind of internationally, but also joint service. The F-35 has opened up so much in regards to being able to fly with those other countries and other services. I mean, it's pretty rare that we get to integrate with even other services, unless you're in some huge exercise, maybe like Red Flag or really that's kind of the only opportunity. And so a lot of our young guys don't really get the opportunity to talk to, you know, Navy, Marine pilots, much less international guys. So, I mean, even back in, I know, 2017, I was in Kadena with the F-35 and we got to go talk to the Marine pilots at Iwakuni who were also just standing up an F-35 squadron. And just to talk back and forth to them with, you know, how are you implying this or, you know, applying this airplane to the near peer threats, the double digit SAMs, and hearing them talk about their seed tactics and how we were doing it, it just kind of opened up our eyes. And we were able to bounce ideas off of each other. And that's all because we're flying the exact same jet and trying to figure out how to employ this stealth technology in a different way. And then, you know, it opens up the avenue to go internationally and go do these exercises with, you know, the Italians or the Brits and talk about, you know, how we're going to all fly F-35s together. Because we're all using the sort of, you know, the same sensors, the same displays, and that just makes us much more tactical as a, you know, whole force concept than we ever were before.
Bayo, I want to continue to talk to you about something, and that's air to air and how you view executing that mission differently when it comes to fighting in an F-35 versus a legacy type. I realize that your time in a legacy type was really limited to your instruction in an F-16D before you had an opportunity to jump to the F-22. But if you can speak to going from fourth gen to fifth gen and how you get that particular air-to-air part of the job done.
Yeah, like you said, I've got three flights and a Viper, and none of that was really tactical. It was kind of like, can you land it before you go fly the F-22 to make sure I don't crash? So nothing tactical in my experience in fourth gen. A lot of what I learned and take from that kind of mentality of a fourth gen pilot is from guys that either swapped over to the F-22 or swapped over to the F-35, and just hearing how they approach air-to-air versus kind of a fifth gen baby like myself. And really, it's just an entirely different mentality air-to-air wise when you're in a fourth versus a fifth gen platform. Because fourth gen, you know, you're seen, you know, it's just a timeout war of can you shoot the other guy before he shoots you down, and hopefully you win. But a lot more losses than hopefully in fifth gen when you know that you can be sneaky and get in there further with that stealth technology. And so just transitioning that mindset is totally different in that hopefully, you know, we're taking shots way before anybody even knows we're there, before they can get a lock on us, you know, sneaking into that within visual range and hopefully being, you know, that much more lethal as a single ship fighter. It's huge. It's a game changer.
So Hazard, we've been talking at Mitchell quite a bit about the concept, and Bayo mentioned it earlier, cost per effect. So I'm glad that it's getting out to the world. And it really means focusing on how best to achieve mission results from an effectiveness and efficiency perspective, not just buying the cheapest thing off the shelf, which may actually end up being more expensive long term. How do you see the F-35 and fifth gen fitting into that construct?
Well, I think cost per effect can be a great concept. So you're trying, you know, trying to get the enemy to capitulate, to, you know, adhere to your demands. And so you're going after their centers of gravity. So it's not just to fly cool jets. So cost per effect is good if Intel knows what the effect will produce, which can be really complicated. And in the past, we've seen Intel kind of overstate, you know, what's going to happen, because you are fighting a thinking adversary that has contingency plans. But if you can understand that, so if the enemy is taking all their ordnance across a bridge, and you know by taking out that bridge that you're going to eliminate them being able to transport that ordnance, then absolutely you want to do what you can and you want to use cost per effect to take it out. I know you covered it in your podcast, so I won't hammer it too much, but the Dragon's Jaw Bridge is in Vietnam, where we spent 7 years and 800 sorties going after a single bridge with dumb bombs. And we lost, I think it was like 11 aircraft going after that one bridge. And it took the advent of laser guided bombs to be able to take that out. So even though an LGB might've cost 10 times the amount of a dumb bomb, you're absolutely going to want to, you know, use that laser guided bomb and just use like 14 sorties instead of 800. And while the F-35 is expensive, it gives you a lot of capability. And another thing we don't talk about too much is the human cost. So cost per effect in terms of money is important to look at. Cost per effect in terms of human cost, I think, is even bigger to look at.
That's a great point. And I never really thought about it that way, Hazard. So thanks for adding that.
I want to talk a little bit about the press surrounding the F-35. And this is a great conversation to have with the both of you, because you both have a social media and public facing perspective on this in terms of getting questions from, you know, the average person who might interact with you either at an air show or on your social media channels. It can be a conversation that you hear centering around reliability or the, you know, per hour cost to fly it. What is your take on this? Bayo, let's start with you. Do you find those questions fair, perhaps maybe a bit just uninformed, or how do you help steer that conversation?
Yeah, I mean, you run the gamut of all the questions that we get on the road. And I wouldn't say most of them are actually informed people that just, you know, are curious or have read something on the news. And it's absolutely their right, because they are the taxpayers that are paying for this jet. And it's our job to make them realize, you know, why is it worth it to buy these jets, continue to buy them, despite, you know, any of the negative press that you're hearing out there. And all I really say is, I mean, it's definitely any new piece of technology or machinery is going to have its bugs and it's going to have those issues. that we're going to continuously being trying to refine and trying to fix and work out. So the F-35 isn't, you know, new to that sort of issue or kind of negative press, but we're trying to show, I mean, this jet is continually undergoing hardware, software upgrades as we speak. And we see that on the line in the combat, you know, squadrons all the time. You know, every couple months, it seems like there's something new on the jet that they're either fixing or improving on. It's continuously becoming better. And even the jets off the line, you know, 1 to 2 to 3 years later are also incorporating those new advancements. So we're continuing to see those things be fixed, and the jet is extremely reliable. I mean, we've sent, even at Hill, all three combat squadrons have been on 6 month deployments already to the Middle East and been very, very effective in what they're doing. So we just try to share that message to people that it is definitely an improving jet and definitely worthwhile.
And Hazard, for you, you know, having dropped into a couple of your live streams on your social media channels and watching the questions coming in, how do you handle that conversation?
Yeah, so I think the bad press comes down to three factors. So one is the paradigm shift in combat aviation. So this happens every 20, 30 years. So if you go back to the 50s and 60s, it was all how high and how fast you could go. So you wanted a jet that could fly 60,000 feet, Mach 2.5. And then in the 70s, that kind of transitioned how tightly you can turn and sustain that turn with folks like John Boyd advocating for that. And since 2000, it's really shifted to now stealth, sensor fusion, great sensors, networking, all the things that you know, aren't sexy at an air show. So if Bayo pops the panels on the F-35 at the air show, nobody's going to care about the computer that's in there. And a lot of it is classified as well, so we can't really highlight that. Next is the technological S-curve. So any technology adheres to the S-curve, where initially when it comes out, there are a bunch of little bugs in it, especially if it's forward-leaning, and the engineers are able to work that out. It hits inflection point, then you see really fast growth, and then it starts to become obsolete. So that's true in fighters. You know, one of the examples I think back of is music. So back in the day, we had Walkman, and it was pretty good. It worked well. And then the CD player came out, and this first CD player was garbage. It was expensive. You had to hold it perfectly flat. It didn't work that well, especially in like a car. And they were able to work it out, all the bugs, and it became pretty good just in time for the iPod to come out. Same thing. It was expensive. You know, you had to use MP3. It was complex. They worked out the bugs. Then you had, you know, Pandora streaming. Same thing. So in 2018, we really hit the inflection curve with F-35 with the 3F software. So it's like your phone or video game. Overnight, the sensors got better. We could pull more Gs. We could pull 9 Gs in the F-35, and it unlocked the gun. So it's really, really like a phone. And in 5 to 10 years, this jet is going to be almost unrecognizable because it is so much software driven. And with like the F-16, you know, Fortune fighters, F-15, they were built back or designed back in the 70s. So they're at the top of the S curve where they're starting to become obsolete. You can't really get as much juice from it. So I think the F-35 is really, you're going to see it hit its stride, which it already has. It already is now, is the Air Force. So that the F-35 is being used. It is the future right now, but 5 to 10 years, it's going to be nearly unrecognizable. And last reason is social media. The F-35 is the first aircraft to grow up in social media. You know, if you think back to the F-16, that was really forward-leaning back in the 70s. If you look at the accident reports, we were losing one almost every 2 to 3 weeks. So if they had social media back then, I think it would have been lit up. So, you know, it is tough to grow up in the social media age for the F-35, but I think you're starting to see it filter to fighter pilots. When I first joined the program back in 2016, fighter pilots were a little bit apprehensive of it. And now almost all my friends have called me trying to see how they can get on board.
I have the good fortune to have conversations with people who fly that jet. And as we are here today, and every person I know who flies it loves it. I want to get back to something you just said. When we talked about this jet being unrecognizable in, you know, 5 to 10 years, if you could have, Hazard, any upgrade that you would like, what would you like to see come to this jet? And then Bayo, I'll give you a chance to think about that as well. We'll come to you next.
more weapons and more power. But I think fighter pilots have been saying that since World War I when they were using revolvers. I think we're on the right path. I think we're really hitting our stride. There are a lot of little things avionics wise that we're cleaning up. But I think we're on the right path, and it is awesome jet, but it's going to be much better in 5 to 10 years.
Bayo, your thoughts?
Lasers. Well, lasers in the jet to shoot down missiles that are coming at me, and lasers to aim at bad people. I don't know. I hear it's down the road, but who knows?
Outstanding.
Pilots with bad attitudes and lasers. I like it. Well, getting a chance to go around the room here with you all and having the both of you today, I've got to ask this because we're really trying to open the aperture on our podcast and really talk a little bit more towards some There I Was stories. So I'm going to ask you, going around, we'll start with Bayo, we'll finish with Hazard. What's your favorite F-35 flying story?
Oh, man. Probably I just enjoy flying in general, just the views that I get to see and the places I get to go. So that is always going to stand out in my mind forever, much probably less than the cool tactical things I do. I just love seeing the world. So probably 2018, the summer, we got to take a four ship to Switzerland for their next fighter competition. And the Swiss were gracious enough as we were leaving a week later to set up some airspace for us. And we got to go fly around the Matterhorn and the Swiss Alps and just rage VFR for a couple minutes. So that was probably one of the highlights. We've got mountains in Utah, but it's nothing like the Swiss Alps.
All right, Hazard.
So I haven't deployed the F-35 to combat like the F-16, but initially when I joined the program, I wasn't a huge fan of the jet. So I think I just had developed a lot of habit patterns in the F-16. And so I was an experienced fighter pilot and I knew what I wanted to do, but it took me 5 seconds or so to figure out how to do it. And at the speeds we fly, that's way too slow. But I remember doing a opset ride towards the end of my my transition. And we were going out against a threat in terms of air-to-air threat and SAM threat that would have been almost impossible in the F-16. And I remember pushing, and it was like being in a shot of valve. So a shot of valve, for people that don't know, is after a sortie, like at red flag or something, we will translate all our data in our jets to this big overall projection, God's eye view of what's going on. And you have 100% SA there. And so, at 16, really, you only have a small piece of the puzzle. You're using a B scope, which is like raw data hits on your radar. But pushing out an F-35 for this opset mission, it was like being in the shot of valve. So I could see all the threats, and we were able to E&E our way around the SAM sites, kill the air threats, drop our bombs, and get out. And it was easy. So that was a big turning point for me.
Believe it or not, I actually have an F-35 flying story that I can share. I had the opportunity to go down to Texas and actually tour the mile-long manufacturing line as a result of Lockheed trying to get ahead of some of the very bad press that we were talking about. There was a number of us who were invited down. They put us in the sim, and myself, who at that point had zero flying time of absolutely anything ever, had no problem taking that jet off. I won't talk about the landing, but my point in sharing that with you is that that jet is designed to be easy to fly. If someone like me who has no experience can successfully launch that jet, it just goes to show you how much technology is on the back end to allow you guys to focus on the battle space. You're not occupied with flying the jet. You get to do what you do. That's my flying story. Glad I got to share it.
Well, thank you, Hazard and Bayo, for those flying stories. And Steph, thanks for sharing your experience in the F-35 simulator. It is an incredible piece of machinery. It's been a pleasure having all of you on today's podcast. That was a great conversation, and I'm glad you got to meet these folks. At the end of the day, no matter how cool the jets are, it ultimately comes down to the airmen that strap into them and fly into harm's way. And the individuals you met today, they are the ones who have taken up that charge. It is important that we equip them to take care of business, get home safe, and be ready to do it all over again tomorrow. That's why aircraft like the F-35 are so important. With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for today's discussion. And to you, our listeners, thank you for tuning in to today's episode of The Aerospace Advantage. If you like what you've heard today, hammer down on that like, follow, and subscribe button wherever you download The Aerospace Advantage. As always, you can join in the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn, or by visiting us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, I'm John Baum. Fly safe and check six.